Behavioral Health Integrations podcast strives to inspire the next generation of mental health and addiction specialists. Our aim is to continue to raise awareness and encourage collaboration in the mental health and addiction industry so that it will continue to thrive. There are numerous approaches to treating mental health and substance abuse issues. On this show, we take pleasure in showcasing the diversity of these approaches used to improve the lives of others. So without further ado, your host, Jacob Minnig.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another Behavior Health Integration episode. Today, we have two very special guests on the show. First up is returning special guest, Randy Anderson. Randy Anderson is the founder and recovery coach, professional trainer, and consultant for Bold North Recovery and Consulting, as well as the new board member of the Minnesota Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy. Next is special guest JP. JP is the owner and founder of Hope Dealers, as well as an addiction counselor in the state of Minnesota. In this special episode, we will be talking many things recovery-based, different things we as behavioral health professionals that can do to, again, improve the field, not only for addiction counselors, certified peer recovery specialists, but for clients as well. What could we do to advocate for ourselves more in the behavioral health field as it comes to better work environments for us, the clients? How can we apply our services better? How do we get the fundings for that? How do we get increased salaries? All this will be mentioned and so much more. So without further ado, let's begin the show. How did you two first meet? I know there's probably different stories, but if you guys want to elaborate on that, I just have to know.
You know, I meet a lot of people in my travels, and I know, I think I knew about Hope Dealers before I actually met JP, because just because of, like, I'm very, very involved with, like, RCO development and RCOs around the state and peer training peers, and I don't know, JP seems to think we met probably at an event or some type of thing at Minneapolis College, which is very likely. I do tons of events there. Mm-hmm. It was probably the first time, my guess is before COVID. Maybe it was Operation Recovery, maybe one of the Operation Recoveries or something. But I can't exactly remember. I know it's been a lot of years, many years since we've known each other. I just don't remember the exact point in time. Maybe JP remembers better than me, but I just don't.
I think I met Randy, man. It probably was multiple times where I mm-hmm. seen him. I think it was like it was something for MCTC. I remember that because I remember Doc introducing me to you. Gotcha. That was one time, and then it was another time we was with March with John Magnuson, and then I bumped into you, and I just kept bumping into you from there, from different seminars and conferences and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's definitely the recovery community, you know. Although a lot of people think it's this vast, big community, it's really a small, tight-knit community in a lot of ways. And everyone knows everyone, or everyone is connected, I think, in some way, too. So it's really cool. But yeah, mm-hmm. I remember going to school, and Bela and Doc would always say, you know, although it's a big field, like, just know that it's a small world. Like, everyone mm-hmm. knows everyone. Like, if you're the guy that, if you want to be the person that, you know, returns emails promptly and things like that, mm-hmm. people remember you. And if you're the guy that doesn't respond promptly, people remember you for that too.
Yep. Yeah. It's a famous saying, don't burn bridges.
Yeah. try not to. I mean, it's, you know, sometimes we all don't agree, but it's okay. Yep. Like, I love that most people in my life, even if we don't agree, we can have respectful conversation about what our viewpoints are. And, you know, that's what it's all about. Right. So, yeah.
Amen.
Try to show some, you know, professionalism that, you know, that, and one of the things, and that's a good point too, Jake, you know, a lot of other fields look at the SUD field, the, you know, counselors and certified peer recovery specialists as like an add-on or an afterthought. And, oh, because I only went to school for 4 years or I only took a 46 hour training or whatever it may be. Right. So, but anyways, this rabbit hole really gets to me because, like, you know, we all have these fun initials after our names that because we went to college, got some certification. My two most important credentials are my 18 years now of recovery and my 5 years of incarceration. But guess what? I don't get initials after my name for those credentials, right? And that I may not be a doctor, didn't go to school for 10 years or, but you know what? I have plenty of life experiences that make me an expert at what I do. Right. So anyways, there's that rabbit hole. I'm going to go down on my soapbox right now, but yeah.
Yeah.
I agree with that. With Randy, a lot of stuff we, you know, went to school for, people got letters behind their names and stuff like that, which is dope. But, you know what I'm saying, to make it out of a lot of experiences, man, that we, you know, overcame and stuff like that. Like people see us now and just, you know, see us, you know, a lot of people just entered like the recovery world and like see us, but haven't had the ability to like see everything that we had to overcome, you know what I mean? To get to the point where we're at in our life, which we had to punch, kick, blood, sweat, and tears, and just everything, and the worry and the mental, you know, the mental stuff. And, you know, not only that, just the stuff back in our past that we had to overcome, you know, imprisonment, you know what I mean? All different types of stuff that we had to endure. You know, a lot of people just, they don't see that, what we had to go through. And I agree with that, Randy. That's like the basis of like who I am, you know, to get me to this point.
I want your guys' 2 cents on this. So a while ago, I don't know if you know who Kevin Doyle is. He's the director of Hazleton for the graduate program. So I had him on, and he wants to change the system as it comes to graduate schools. So he wants to get rid of the bachelor degree for admission, and he wants to there to be a system where he can let people with like 2-year degrees in the master's program, but again, maybe use their military experience as undergrad or the time in treatment centers, like working as a tech, because he feels like that experience is just as valuable as education in the classroom.
Yeah, that's interesting. So I was on I used to serve on the Ramsey County Chemical Health Committee, whatever, it had a big long name. And we had, we're creating this new position for the Ramsey County. And we didn't want to exclude people with lived experience. But a lot of times when you have those, you know, those high requirements, bachelor's degree, master's degree, whatever, right? You exclude the most qualified candidates because they maybe don't have that level. They didn't go to school for that long, or they didn't, whatever. It was really hard though, working within a government system to change how they do business is so, I mean, oh my God, it's so frustrating. But we ended up doing it where we said, so either this level of degree or this many years of experience in related whatever, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. We were able to do that. We worked on it for months with Ramsey County and their human services department and their legal department, because they were so worried about like, you know, well, if this person, you know, they can't. And it was just some of the stigmatizing conversation. Yeah. Like, that's really what it was, because, you know, maybe a person didn't go to school for whatever, 5, 6, 7, 10 years, whatever, right? But they have, you know, lived, you know, done community organizing work for 5 years, right? They've worked in nonprofit world for a long time, but that's a great, that's really a good conversation that we need to be having more of in these spaces. Because like we, so often people, everyone is an expert. I believe everyone is an expert of their own experience, and they're a subject matter expert in something. Mm-hmm. But because they don't have the right credential or initials, they don't even get an interview or get considered for the position. Right. So I like the idea. I think that's a good conversation we should be having. So thanks.
Yep.
Yeah. I think that's a great idea. A lot of people got their PhDs from the street, you know, and been out there for like 30 years. And, you know, like Randy said, they have their own life experiences about different things, like, you know, experiencing homelessness and, you know, incarceration, just all type of stuff. Yeah. And I think that, you know, you don't have to go to school to learn the same stuff you have to learn, you know, what you learned already. So I think that's a good idea with the master's degree program.
And even this is a good topic. It's interesting when I finished my associate's degree in addiction counseling at Minneapolis College, MCTC, right? And then I went on to get my bachelor's, and I looked at Metro, but they didn't have a schedule that fit my life really well. And then there's an amazing counselor or a career counselor at Metro that, if you know, so Karen Jacks, she's
shout out.
Yeah. Shout out to Karen Jacks.
She's amazing. Love you, Karen. Yeah, I met with her once before I decided where I was going to, and we talked about what I was looking for and my goals and my schedule. And she said to me, I don't know if Metro is the best fit for you. And I was like, what? Like, nobody. And like, she goes, here's some other programs that offer different, know, ways of, you know, participating that might fit better in your life schedule. So she gave me a few names. I ended up landing on Bethel. It was expensive. It was a little bit more expensive than, but what it was this 24-month cohort program that met once a week, some in person, some online, just depending, but it fit my life schedule. And I was blown away. Like, Karen's my hero for doing this. I tell you this story all the time. Like, if it hadn't been for that good advice, I don't know how successful I would have been. But why I mention this is Bethel, they gave me some adult learning credit for some of the things that I've done in my life. Like, I had to submit, like, I got whatever it was. I don't remember at the time. I'd have to look back. But I ended up getting, I think, 3 or 4 semester credits for my life experience stuff.
Oh, wow.
And that's huge. I mean, that at $700 a credit or whatever it was at Bethel, like, that saved me thousands of dollars besides, right? So, I mean, absolutely. So that's something that, like, I'm totally, you know, people that adult learning, people should get credit for some of that stuff they've already done. I'm 53 years old. Like, I've been around, right? Yep. I know some things. And so I should get some of, there should be a way to get some kind of credit for that, right? And Bethel, kudos to them. They did that a little bit, but yeah.
Karen Desch was my advisor at one point in time too, Randy. So I agree with that. Shout out to Karen. She still communicates. She still helped me out with a lot of different type of stuff. She's amazing.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, definitely.
Hey, I was curious, what was that court thing you guys were both involved in? Or you went down to the courthouse, it's like 3-4 months ago.
You mean the Capitol?
Yeah, sorry. It was the fancy.
I try to stay away from courthouse.
We try to stay away from that, Jake.
Capitol.
I'm going with a really participant to go to court with them. Otherwise, I try to stay away from that. But anyway, I'm kidding. So totally kidding. I had in 2018, I had started working on the background study stuff because I got disqualified. I've been disqualified 7 times by DHS. I've done 4 set asides. Like, I've helped dozens of people, maybe hundreds of people, you know, start their set aside or complete their set aside. But this is something that I started working on in like 2018.
What's a set aside?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. So if you're a person that has a criminal record or criminal history, even in some cases, and you work in a professional capacity. So in Minnesota, you work in a DHS licensed program. You have to go through a background study and they pull your record. And if you have, you know, depending on your crime, you get disqualified. And there's several levels of disqualification. The statute, if anyone is, I'm a nerd when it comes to stuff, I read policy and legislation and statute all the time, but it's called 245C15. It's the Minnesota statute that governs background studies. So anyways, so people like myself, who again are the most qualified individuals, often get disqualified because of my criminal background and JP. Yeah. So anyway, so I've worked on this for many years. This last session, we actually finally got some. So Gina, I'm going to give a shout out to Gina Evans. She's the architect of this, but it's something I've been involved with for years. Gina kind of took it over and I was like, great. Cause I didn't have the capacity anymore to do it, but this year we introduced legislation to change some of that. It's like, so for, especially around like low level drug crimes, 5th degree possession, things like that, like to automatically set aside, not to disqualify them because they have these low level drug crimes. Right. There's so much more work that we need to do, but anyways, this is all we could get done this year. It was very little, to be honest, but I'm not trying to like, I'm never satisfied. Like, I mean, I think when it comes to this kind of stuff, like we should be doing so much more, but you got to do what you got to do, right? The wheels of the government, it's like making the sausage, as they love to say, it goes really slow, right? But anyway, so JP, we're looking for people that have been impacted by the background studies besides me, because Randy, you know, everybody hears some Randy. I testify all the time. Everyone knows who I am. I mean, it's fine. I don't always have to be the guy to speak. And so we had reached out to JP and said, hey, we know he had been disqualified or had some criminal stuff that has prevented him from moving forward. And we know that the war on drugs and mass incarceration disproportionately impacts people of color, indigenous people, people that don't look like me, right? And so it's enough of the same white guy talking all the time. I mean, I hate to say it that way, but it's true, right? We want to hear from the people that are really most impacted by this. And JP is one of those people. So we asked him to come to the Capitol and provide testimony about how this background studies system has impacted and prevented him from, in some cases, moving forward. So anyways, that's what we did. It was really cool.
I remember JP at work. He was pumped for that. I remember.
Yeah, I was kind of pumped. I
nervous. You're a little nervous, maybe.
Randy, I already know because he tends to make me more nervous than what I actually am during the time it happens. But yeah, it was you know, I was talking to Gina for a while. I've been, you know, doing some stuff with Gina. She came to the recovery gym and spoke about like expungement and stuff. So I've been in contact with her about different things, man. It was just dope that I got the call. You know, so I appreciate that, Randy. You know, got the call to get a chance to like tell my story or just, you know, be a part of that type of change, man. Cause it's, you know, I had to jump through some hoops to, you know, get a set aside and stuff like that. Pretty much like Randy, I had to go through the appeal process, you know, cause I got disqualified like 3 times or something like that. So yeah, just to, you know, have the opportunity to do that, man, and just, you know, try to be a part of that change, man. Cause a lot of people are not getting, a lot of people going to school or trying to go to school to be a counselor, and they can't get past that hurdle because of the past stuff that they did. And, you know, working with Gina and the Second Chance Coalition and stuff like that, like, you know, it's people are actually trying to change their life, you know. So it's it's discouraging for people like that, you know, if they can't get past that barrier or past that hurdle to like continue, you know, their growth in life and stuff like that. So it's just amazing, man. I got a chance to do that. I wanted to do the best I could, man. So I got kind of really nervous. Thanks to Randy, I got really, really nervous. But I think it, you know, it was good for him to hear that, I guess. And I think it's going bipartisan, right?
Yeah. What up, Stephanie? I see Stephanie on there. I know Steph. Hey, what's up, Stephanie? Yeah, thanks for watching.
I just saw a white woman who easily received a positive court outcome having a pound of marijuana. Okay. Made me sick to see people struggling to get help. Okay. Yeah.
Thanks, Stephanie. I remember giving JP a little advice or coaching, just, hey, just be yourself, man. Just tell your story. That's what it's about. Mm-hmm. I do, as you guys know, I do tons of legislative work, and, you know, I call myself like a citizen lobbyist. I don't get paid a dime to do it, but I think it's.
Randy, can I say something, man?
Yeah.
I get so tired, in a good way, watching you do all the things you do just on social media. I wish I had your energy, man. I swear to God, I wish I had half of it. It's like you're in Mexico, Vegas, Arizona, Wisconsin, and I'm like, oh, God, I'm tired. Good for you, though.
A lot of people say that. I don't know how, sometimes I wonder how I do it all as well, but I don't know. I just have a calendar and I just do shit. Like, excuse my French, but I probably should watch my language a little bit on here. But it's like, I forgot where I was going with that now, but, I love doing advocacy and legislative work. And this year, actually, it's funny. I was up at the Capitol, you know, I wrote my own bill last year and, the year before last, and then this last session got a little bit farther and we'll try again next year. Didn't make it, but like I got offered 2 lobbying jobs this year and I turned them down. I said, no, you know what? Cause if once I get paid to be doing this, now I'm beholden or answering to a business or a company or an organization's agenda. Right. And the way I look at it is here, when I do the work I do, who I answer to is my recovery community. And oftentimes, and this is the sad part, and I know people have busy lives and they're not like Randy, and that's fine. And I'm a unique, rare breed sometimes of certain things. But oftentimes, as we look at the things that are happening at the Capitol, very rarely is there a recovery voice present or at the table. And I'm done with those days. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, I'm going to be there, even if I'm like just, I don't know. My dad used to say either you have a seat at the table or you're probably on the menu. And I'm not on anyone's menu. I'm going to tell you that. And I want to be a voice for my recovery community. And I'm not saying I'm the expert on every single topic and every issue, but I just want to make sure that when laws are being passed and all these things that happen at Capitol affect people in recovery. And I want to make sure that's a thought, like, hey, like when we do anything, like how is this going to impact the recovery community, right? And that's my mission, my goal is just to make sure that recovery voice gets heard, and I have the time and I have the energy, and you know I'm lucky I have some resources mostly to my wife. I'm going to shout out to my wife because she has a good job and can afford to pay our bills more what I do doesn't make a whole lot of money, but mm-hmm. but it's I feel it's so important. I have a very supportive spouse. Without that, I wouldn't be able to do what I do. So yeah.
Yeah, man. It's just I agree again with Randy. Like we do what I do for the recovery community, man. You know, it's like my life is based on it, you know, recovery now. So, you know, I want to be a voice for like the recovery community and stuff, especially again, like all the stuff we've been through and overcame, and people out here in early recovery, it's people out here that don't have a voice, and it's people out here that are just trying to better themselves and give and do the most with a second chance, you know? And I just want to be around people who like-minded people, you know what I'm saying, with the same vision and stuff like that too.
Sorry about that.
So we can try to advance. We can try to advance the recovery community, you know, and try to empower people and encourage people, man, to, you know, to change their life without having to think like, you know, hey, if I do this, then this might happen. This is might not go through. And, you know, just try to pave the way like people paved the way for us, you know, and just try to continue that for people that's coming along, you know, in the future.
Hey, Brenda, what's up? I see Brenda out here. I know Brenda.
Oh, what's up, Brenda?
In the comments come through in the bottom of the screen, and I know so far a few people I've known have been commenting. That's great. So,
Randy, another thing that I love that you do is just your advocacy, just for, let's say, like the LADC, the peer recovery specialist, about like better work conditions, more pay. And I know there's a lot that goes into it, but again, that's another thing I appreciate of you, because we discussed that a little bit on my last episode with you. I forgot where you said you worked, but you were doing like, you had like a 25 client case. I could be wrong, but it's ridiculous.
Well, I haven't worked in direct care in quite a while. So, and I don't know when, I don't remember. It has been a while since I've been on the show too. So, I don't even know. Like when I was working, the last place I worked as a, you know, in a helper's role as a counselor was Eden House. And at one time, because of staff shortages, I mean, I had a caseload of, you know, 16 or more clients, and in a residential program,
anxiety just thinking about that.
In a residential program, like that's impossible. And it's, I'm not blaming the program. We had, you know, severe staff shortages. And so everyone like, but the part that I get, like, it hurts me, like really hurts me to my core. And is when we're so overwhelmed and understaffed, and you know who gets hurt the most in that is the people we serve. And that's why I realized, like, I'm a much better working outside of that system. First of all, is better for my mental health and my like, I mean, literally when I quit working as a counselor, it was my wife, I was doing discharge summaries at 10 o'clock at night in bed, like on my laptop, because I was so far behind and I just couldn't keep up. She says, this is it. You're done. Like you got to find something else. And so that's really what got me to change directions. But now I still want, like, the field is very important to me. Right. And so I can see how I can help the field from a different way, like through advocacy and legislative work and help training the workforce and providing the education. Like for me, like that's, and I am not a guy, I realize I am not a guy that can be tied to a building or a location. I have to be on the move. Like, as you can point it out, like I gotta be moving around, like, right. But that's where I'm most helpful. Like, I think one of my gifts to the world is I'm a connector. I know how, I may not have the right answer for you, but I know the person that does. And that's one of my gifts, I think, is to connect people to people. But that only happens because because of my traveling and my networking and all that. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think I'm effective in that sense, too. I don't know if you know this, but me and Randy are part of the Minnesota Recovery Advocacy Project, right, Randy?
Yeah.
In Minnesota.
It's we're part. I would say we're there, you know, just the Recovery Advocacy Project is we have a little division or branch called Minnesota Recovery Advocacy Project. Hasn't ever taken off very well, but that's because everyone's busy and it's just. The way it goes.
But I think just to piggyback off that, it's just it's fun for me to connect with people. to build those bridges and connections for other people and have resources for other people. You know, it started off with me. It was just like somebody asking me for something like, hey, do you know a residential inpatient or this a place for kids? And I just started looking it up and just started gathering resources like for myself and going out and meeting people and, you know, just gathering these resources. If I don't know something, I ask Randy. You know, but you know, if you know, it's
a lot of people, you know, do that, JP.
Yeah. I already know. So it's, you know, but it's I'm like building my resource bank for people, you know, to ask me. A lot of people ask me about a lot of stuff, you know, but I do my best to like just be supportive with people and stuff and what they're trying to do. And, you know, and, you know, sometimes people, it's not even about the questions that they ask. It's just, you know, people just want you to. It's just they want to feel supported, you know, with different things and stuff like that. So I take it as an honor that people come and ask me, like, for resources and different things like that. And I try to do my best to put a lot into that, to have those resources and build those resources for people. So, you know, I can have that connection with people to help the people that's asking for the help, you know.
Yeah. Thank you, Brenda.
Well, hey, I see Alyssa, too, commenting. I hope I'm Alyssa. I'm probably saying her name wrong. But that it's ridiculous, you know, bringing my job home with me. Yeah, it's like, I think if you work in this field, unfortunately, I mean, you try to set those boundaries, but it's just like, it's just overwhelming. And then you're, you know, I always had good bosses. So I'm going to say it was never the reason I left was because of a boss. But they have a job to do too. Right. And they're constantly saying things like, we gotta be in compliance. All you hear is the word compliant.
And yes.
I have nightmares. I have goosebumps right now. That word compliance haunts me. Because
Randy, is the treatment director saying this to you mostly?
Yeah. 100%. And I know she's, and I had a great treatment director. And she was funny, when I was in treatment at Eden House, where I worked as a counselor many years later, she was the treatment director then too. But she's got a job to do too. And she's not trying to make it any harder on us, but compliance, everything. And then, you know, I don't intentionally like to bash DHS. That's not ever my goal.
Bash them. I bash them all the time. They need to get bashed more.
I say it all the time. I'm always in a fight with DHS. They might not admit it, but like, even the system they have, one small example of what really drives me a little batshit crazy. I hate to say the word crazy, but drives me nuts, is like this shaming system they have where they send out those emails of all the programs that are having, so I'm on there, it's a licensing audit. It's a list. They send out an email of every program that gets audited, and then all of their corrections and all of their mistakes and all of their, like, I mean, I get it. Like, that stuff needs to be available, like, in some way for the public to see, but it's like they assume everyone is doing it on purpose or committing fraud or like they, and I, it's not true. Like, it's just not like most programs I know, most people I know are really trying to do the right thing. And, but the system is, it's set up for them to look for the faults instead of look for the good stuff. Right. And a kudos to Twin City Recovery Project. I know I just talked to Paul. They went through their first audit and they had very few infractions, which is great. I love hearing that.
Yo, JP.
Yeah, great to go, guys. I know Crystal works her butt off. I know Crystal really well, but I just think that whole
system, I need to get her on the show too. I gotta get her on the show.
I think the whole system needs a lot of overhaul. I said that when I was working on my bill this last session, and so there's this nice lady at DHS called Christy Grom. She's the liaison between the governor's office, DHS, and the legislation. And she's in the Capitol all the time. And I've known Christy for years. So I wrote that. She pulls me aside before this hearing for my bill and says, "What is this, Randy? Like, what is this all about?" And I, we dropped it. I'm not going to lie. Like, we had a strategy to drop it as late as possible because we knew that they were going to come after it. Like, this is not, you know, what we want. Da, da, da. And I said, Christy, and I said to her jokingly, I said, "Christy, I know everyone over there hates me, and that's okay." I said, you know, and she goes, "Well, Randy, we don't hate you. You just have a lot to say all the time." I'm like, "Well, of course I do, because somebody's got to do it. Like, right? I can't sit on the sidelines. Like, I can't do it." And so anyways, but it's hard. But for the first time ever, I got DHS to say, on my bill. It didn't, again, it didn't pass, but they didn't oppose it, but they wouldn't support it at this time either. But it was to me, that was a huge win to hear DHS said they don't oppose something that I thought of, like, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Ready, this is a good, so Stephanie, most programs are understaffed, which is increased errors.
Yeah.
How many CPRSs do we really need?
Well, so the problem with the CPRS workforce is, in my opinion, and this is what my bill was looking to address, is there's a lack of oversight and a lack of good supervision. And those two are things make a dangerous combination. So we need to do some work around making sure that our peer workforce is supervised appropriately, and that we're having some oversight and accountability in the field, because right now it's kind of the wild, wild west, and we're seeing some concerning things because of that. So how many do we need is a great question. We don't know that until we have a system in place that better supports our CPRSs, better supervises our CPRSs, and make sure the work is being done, you know, effectively, ethically, legally, all that stuff. So I think there's a lot to do in the space. But I mean, I think, I envision a world one day when I think of, and I'm sorry, I'm hijacking this conversation, you guys.
No,
I think the world one day where, like, I think we have some really big companies in Minnesota, like 3M, Medtronic, Mayo, like big companies, right? I envision a day one time where if a person is struggling with substance use problems, they can go to their HR department and say, you know, I'm struggling. And they can say, hey, we have this recovery coach on staff that you can meet with and to see, maybe they can help guide you some direction, right? That's a world one day I see. So when Stephanie asked, how many do we need? A lot is the question. But before we can get a lot, I really want us, we're kind of right now, I think, a cart in front of the horse, because we just haven't created a good system how to effectively do that yet. But we're working on it. I'm actively, that was an important one for me, obviously, because I think, I do believe that peer recovery specialists or recovery coach are, we are the glue that fills the gaps. I mean, we can catch people and really meet them where they are and don't leave them where they're at. But that's, I love saying meet them where they are, but just don't leave them where they're at in that case. Yeah. Let's help them get to the next thing, whatever that is for them, right? And I think that's where the peers really fit into the puzzle too. So anyways, I'm gonna stop, get off my soapbox, because I could hijack the whole conversation, which I already done. So anyways, but yeah.
No, it's cool, Rand. But yeah, I help train peer recovery specialists and, you know, work with certified peer recovery specialists as well, too, recovery coaches. And it is a need for them outside of the clinical, inside and outside of the clinical setting, to be honest with you. And they do fill up the gaps in between treatment or whatever, you know, and people in recovery. Like, it's a supplemental thing for anybody just want to get through recovery. I was going to say treatment, but, you know, necessarily everybody, it's not everybody's pathway,
right,
to recovery, you know? So it's just a CPRS is an important piece. And like Randy said, glue to somebody's recovery, you know, to give them some, you know, just somebody to be there to walk with them, you know, yeah, walk with them through, navigate uncharted waters, so to speak, you know, especially for people who've been experiencing addiction for years, man. And they're just getting into being in recovery, or even people in long-term recovery. You know, some people have multiple years of recovery, but still don't have any type of direction, or still just need some support in navigating through what recovery looks like and meeting them where they at. And, you know, I think that's an important thing.
Yeah. Now, shout out to two of my former students that are on here, Paul and Stephanie. I'm going to break my arm and pat myself on the back and say, great job, guys. And I appreciate your input and the things they're both doing in the field now. Like Paul's, I think he's more located in over on the West Coast now, but still doing his own stuff with coaching and peers. And then Stephanie, who, shout out to Nirvana Wellness. That Stephanie had started on, I think it's her own little business that she's trying to get up and running. It looks like some cool stuff. So check it out. Nirvana Wellness. I hope I'm saying that correctly, but yeah, anyways.
Yeah. I love the fact that we're talking about, like, let's say, like, people at work who feel like they're struggling with alcohol and addiction or not. And then again, they could just go to a peer recovery specialist at their HR or their work. Because I cannot tell you, gentlemen, how many doctors I've had on my show or nurses where I hear stories about them being too afraid to go to HR because of their issues, because of how they might lose their job or might face stigma or just be looked down upon by the other medical field for having problems or issues, just like as humans, we all have.
No, substance abuse doesn't. I mean, I'm not, it's everywhere, right? It's not, it's big. I mean, everybody, you could line up 10 people and one out of every one of those 10 people have a substance use problem, right? I mean, we just know that. That's the numbers. And that's why, I mean, so there's other thing that I wish we would start to adopt more in Minnesota. A few states have done it, and maybe you've heard of it, but it's called the Recovery Friendly Workplace.
Hmm.
Where, oh my God, it's so, I know Hazleton had started to work on this, and my friend Tori Utley from Doc's Recovery House was involved with it. I don't know where they're at with it. I'd love to, I'd love to circle back with them when I have time. Like, I don't know when that'll be, but there's states that are implementing more broad sweeping. In fact, even the Department of Labor, Marty Walsh, the United States Department of Labor, has introduced like that more, they want more companies to introduce this recovery friendly workplace where people aren't afraid to admit that they're struggling with something and then seek help for that instead of shaming them and firing them or whatever we love to do, like provide them support. Like, I mean, that's, so there is a, there's an initiative starting to move around the country around that. And I really love it. I wish, I can't believe Minnesota's not out in the forefront of it with our huge treatment industry, but you know, a treatment, I'm not, and I think treatment works. It worked for me. So I'm not going to here to throw out treatment, but it's a big money maker, right? It's a $6 billion a year industry that, I mean, and they benefit from people cycling through the system too, right? Like all of our other systems, right?
Nobody wants to talk about that. But
nobody wants to talk about it. I'm not here to bash treatment because treatment saved my life. I went to a treatment program that worked for me, right? So I'm
some treatments.
Right. Right. So, but they make money when we hear people say, I've been to treatment 15 times and seven, like that's what they want. I mean, that's what the treatment industrial complex, like that's what they want. Like, right.
Oh, Randy, could we get into the relationships too regarding that and the relationships they have with sober houses and then treatment centers, sober houses and treatment centers?
Well, and so we, thank God in Minnesota, we're not as bad as what we've seen in California and Florida with the, if you haven't seen the movie Body Brokers, watch it.
This is like getting juicy. This is getting juicy.
That is true, true stuff that happens and still happening probably in some communities.
What's it called, Randy? I'm gonna write that down.
Body Brokers.
Body Brokers.
Okay. Body Brokers. It's based on actual events of treatment centers and sober living homes in California. It's disgusting, but it also, people should see it to see what we don't want to have happen. So we're fortunate enough in Minnesota that I think we have some more, we have more ethical people than less ethical people, right? But there's, I mean, no matter where you go, there's people that are want to grab money, right? And I always tell people, if you're getting into this business to make money, get out, like, or you're in the wrong business. Now, should you be able to make a living and be able to pay your bills and take a nice vacation once in a while and save some money for retirement? Absolutely. But if you're doing it because you want to get rich and own the $1 million home and have the sports cars and have a, you know, whatever, like, you're just taking advantage of a system. And now I'm not for that. Like, I want to make money too. And I want to have nice things and pay bills, but I don't want to do it at the expense of people and tax dollars. Right. I could go down this rabbit hole, but the state this year, we passed the biggest tax increases in state history. Right. Our new budget is $72 billion for the next biennium. That is a $20 billion increase from our last biennium. That's a lot. That's my tax. It's all of our tax dollars hard at work right there, right? I want them to invest those tax dollars wisely. And if you're committing fraud or misusing the system, I want you to be held accountable because that's my money. So,
Randy, I have a question. I mean, you can help me out. It might be a dumb question, but like, what is the difference between like a for-profit treatment center and a nonprofit? Like, does that mean anything with taxes or anything? Or
it's just a tax designation. It really means nothing. There are plenty of nonprofit that make tons of money.
Okay.
So it's how your business structure and tax structure is set up. So like, I have Bold North Recovery LLC is my, it's a for-profit. Like, if I don't have to have a board, I'm the CEO, like, right. I'm in charge. I don't have to answer to anyone except for myself. Like, right. So I get to decide. nonprofits have to have a board structure where you have a board that oversees, and the and also with nonprofits, you have, it's a pub, so you have to disclose publicly, like how much money you've made, how much money you've spent, like things like 990s. I don't have to do that with my LLC. I will though. Like I got a grant, you know, for the first time as a for-profit business, I had to send them 3 years tax records. Fine. I don't have an issue with that. Like I'm not hiding anything. So I will give you my tax records. No problem. Like, right. But some for-profits, they get to shield or hide their tax. It's not public knowledge. So anyways, but there it's a tax designation. And, but I mean, we have some big ones and I'm not, I love these programs. New Way is a big nonprofit, makes plenty of money. RS Eden, big nonprofit, makes plenty of money, but they're just called a nonprofit because they have a board structure and they have and they have to be public. The public has to be able to access their financial records.
I also want to kind of get into, again, talking about peer recovery specialists and their roles in treatment centers. Cause I know we talked about this last time too. I've worked with many recovery specialists who got burnt out because again, not understanding their scope of practice. And Randy, that's what I first fell in love with your system. And I still think about that poster you had that I absolutely love that actually explains everything, everybody's job duties, what they should be called and how they should interact with one another when it comes to, again, work responsibilities. And when that does not occur, burnout happens.
Yeah. Yeah. My who's who at the zoo presentation. But yeah, it's it clearly lays out the lanes for counselor, sponsor, tech, and peer recovery specialist, right? And I you know, when I and JP, I feel so bad. I'm like hijacking the conversation here.
No, it's cool. Go ahead, man.
When I helped work on when we got Medicaid reimbursement for peer services back in, we started in 2017, we passed in 2018. I was at some of those meetings and I thought it was why wouldn't we do this? It seems like the natural progression. It just makes sense. Unfortunately, I've seen some of, now we see, look, after we've had it for 4 or 5 years, we see some of the unintended consequences that we didn't think about when we did it. I now, if you ask me now, I would probably oppose Medicaid reimbursement for peers. only because as soon as you added a financial incentive to it, you change the dynamic of some of that. Not all of it. I mean, there's a lot of us doing great work out here, a lot of peers doing great work, but a lot of treatment centers see this as a way to grab some money.
Yep.
And not necessarily deliver the high quality service that goes along with that. And I'm not trying to bash any particular program or organization, but we've seen it. It's just proofs in the pudding. And so when you start asking peers, they can get paid now. There's treatment centers having them do UAs and room searches and van driver and things like that. Here, Paul's writing it. Paul is great. Paul's like, yeah, passing meds. Like I argued with a treatment director one time why I am opposed to a peer recovery specialist doing med calls. I said, so I worked as a tech, but I said, let's just say that peer recovery specialist observes a med call and he catches a client cheeking their medications. What has to happen? Well, they have to, you know, write a report. They have to put it in their file. They have to, they've now just become another punitive aspect of that individual's life. And they said, how we prevent that is we don't put them in the position to begin with. So if we don't put them in a position where they have to necessarily be that punitive person, and then people say, well, you know, peers are nothing more than tree huggers and they don't hold anyone accountable. I said, that's absolutely not true. I said, I just do it in a different way. As a peer, I'm going to say to someone very bluntly, like, hey, hold on. I hear you saying this, but I see you doing this. Help me understand. Explain to me why that's okay. Like, right. I'm holding them accountable, but not being such an asshole while doing it. Right. So anyways, but yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that, man. It's peer. It's supposed to be peer to peer, right? Not peer to punitive. You know, so it's just like, you know, you being there for support and being punitive is not technically there for support. And they see if that role has changed, they see a dynamic that's missing there and becomes like a little bit more authoritative. Mm-hmm. You know, they become like an authority figure, like, oh, here go peer recovery specialist. Let me just not do, you know, instead of being more, trusting or, you know, embrace more and stuff like that. So that's where that dynamic turned it also. where it's looked like as they being a part of staff, or they being a part of this, or being above them or below them, when it's supposed to just be like peer to peer.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Peer to peer, and peers can hold each other accountable.
Right.
Just like Randy said, but it's in the, I think that was the whole dynamic of the peer recovery specialist, is to be able to relate to that specific individual with what they're trying to do as far as within that recovery, you know, not handle other things as far as like Randy said, UAs, or, you know, reporting information, and, you know what I mean? That type of stuff. Like, hey, you know.
Yeah, and every once in a while, like, roles are blurred, because I know me and you, JP, we've observed UAs before and work counselors and everything, and
yeah.
Technically that's not our job. Well, our UA people actually don't do that either, which is weird, but yeah.
It is a clinical service.
Yeah, it's a clinical thing. Yeah,
so a UA is considered it's ordered by a doctor or a treatment director, or so it's considered a clinical service, where peers are considered non-clinical.
Yeah. Right. When they start doing clinical stuff, that changes the dynamic and role of it. I mean, we got to do it, but like we kind of got to do it, that type of stuff. You know what I'm saying? But I wish it was some other people to do it. But you know, like, we in the clinical setting. So, you know, the clinical setting versus non-clinical, even though they're in the clinical setting, type of thing. So it's like,
I would prefer if there was a whole, I mean, as a counselor, I agree though. I don't want to do them. I would prefer let the techs do it. Right. That's to me, that's a perfect job for a tech there. And the techs are important, a hugely important piece of the puzzle for people's recovery and treatment, but they're the ones that get to be the rule enforcers. They are the van drivers. They're the bed checks, that's what they do. And they can also be a listening ear sometimes for the clients. Right. I'm telling you, the tech, there's a guy named Ray at Eden House, worked there for years. I think he's finally retired. If it wasn't for Ray, I don't know if I'd have stayed there many times, because Ray convinced me why this was better for me than what the alternative was, right? Mm. So, I mean, they play a role. It's just like, and that's why even my Who's Who in the Zoo, I kind of give them the polar bear. I put them as the polar bear, because everyone loves to look at a polar bear. They look all like, oh, they're so friendly. But a polar bear will rip your head off. It will eat your arm, right? And that's kind of the thing. Like, a tech to me is like, they look all nice and they're friendly to you, but break the rules or do something you're not supposed to be doing, and they'll rip your head off, right?
Yeah.
I think I was a personal Who's Who at the Zoo. I sat in your presentation too that day, Randy. I sat in that Who's Who at the Zoo. I remember that. But, you know, I was a tech too before I got my, after my internship, I had to wait for my license and stuff to come back. So that's what I was doing, driving, you know, the van driving, UAs. Hey, don't do that. Yeah. You know, don't eat, and, you know, type of stuff. So
I think that's the great way to get into the field as a tech.
My first job in the field was a tech.
Yeah, man. Actually, too, so to speak. I was I worked in the detox.
Yeah, if I could see the natural progression, you know, I think I said to DHS, like, why don't you come be a counselor for a couple days and tell me how hard it is, right? Because they come in there and getting into the field first as a tech, just to understand that role. And then, you know, if you want to go the next level, like become a CPRS or a certified peer recovery specialist, and then if you decide you want to further your education and go on to counseling, great. But like, that progression is a really good path for some people. I did it a little backwards. I was a tech first and a counselor. Then I decided to go into the peer world because I feel most at home as a peer. Like, I feel a lot less guarded. I feel I can share more openly. I don't have to be the punitive person in their life, like to tell their PO and report on them and all that stuff. So that's just, I just feel at home in the peer lane.
That's the way I took. So like Randy says, like, it was a progression for me. So I was like a tech first. I worked at detox as a tech, taking people's blood pressures and stuff. Mm-hmm. And it was dope. You know, got a chance to get my feet wet in that. Then I became a peer recovery specialist, and I got certified. And then I think I made a turn, because while I was in college going for addiction counseling, I started the Minnesota Hope Dealers. So I think I became a RCO before I actually went into my internship to be a counselor. Yeah. So I went that way turned backwards somehow. But I was more involved with the peer stuff. But not really backwards. I wouldn't say that, because if I went to CPRS and then started my own RCO and then became a counselor, I would say that's a progression.
Yeah.
So to speak.
Yeah. I know there's a lot of different titles and you don't know which one's higher than the other, because like I did the route of like a tech, then I was a mental health group home worker, but then I was an armed CTSS worker. And then I was a temp counselor to counselor to like now. So there's a lot of different roles that are kind of intertwined or in between.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
And another thing that I'm seeing treatment centers do, obviously not the one we're at or whatnot, but my past ones, they're actually, which is kind of conflicting to what you're saying, Randy, is they're like offering to pay techs to go to peer recovery school or whatever. So they could be techs and peer recovery specialists at the same treatment center. Yeah, I wonder what their motives are.
Money. Well, so once they become a certified peer recovery specialist and they're a 245G program, they can then now start to bill for some of those interactions between patients or clients and the tech. Mm. And that's why they're doing it, because now they're seeing a way. This is where I said, if I could go back now and like I've seen the unintended consequences, the treatment programs. And I like, so in their defense, I will say like, I was just looking at the, data in this session, although we passed some good stuff, once again the SUD field was left out of a rate increase, so we did not get another rate increase. And now people say, oh well, you got the 1115 waiver, which boosted, but that's only if you're enrolled and you're that type of program, otherwise you didn't get. So I was just looking and it said, many of you are acutely aware that since SUD rates were set in 2011, there has only been a 2% and a 1% increase in the base rates.
That's horrible.
2011. So,
that's horrible.
Right. And so, and now because of the competitive workforce, and you see these programs offering, you know, $5,000 and $10,000 signing on bonuses, like, so the people that have the money are able to hire the more workers, right? So these small programs that aren't able to do that, they're struggling. And so a way to grab some more funding is to have these peer recovery specialists now being billed, and that it's a dangerous slope. I mean, there's going to be at a point where that will collapse in some point, and we'll see, but peers are just going to, if we don't figure this out quickly, and one of the reasons for my bill is to provide clarity for that. If we don't figure it out, we're going to destroy the peer role. Like I agree. If we don't start to like do better to separate those roles, we're going to ruin what peer services are in the state of Minnesota. We've already seen it happening in other states.
Randy, can I add to that?
Yeah.
Tell the program to the DHS, which is, it's not easy even being 1115. It is not an easy process, and you need the particular staff.
Correct.
You need licensed professional clinical counselors or at least master level clinicians at a certain percentage to even be eligible for the 1115. Yep.
Well, or you need to have an MOU agreement with an organization that, or a mental health organization that does. So it does still require you to have either agreements or staff, depending on. But yeah, no, it's not. It's by no means. I mean, I'm glad they're moving away from that, you know, cap. Because really, it was all about breaking apart the mental health institutions from the 50s and 60s, right? And what we did is we then created a system where, like with us, this putting this cap on how many patients we can have on in a group or whatever it be to get qualified as an IMD. I get the whole thing. I mean, I know enough about the history, but I also see like, yeah, they gave us all 10% raise, all the programs that are 1115, but they make us jump through a shit ton of hoops to do that. So what else you want to ask about, Jake?
Well, I'm kind of curious about your new role
as a
board member. Congratulations, by the way, again.
Thank you.
Would you like to explain to us a little bit more about that and your new glorious, awesome, cool responsibilities now?
Yeah, I just got, so those that don't know, I'm going to brag. I don't brag about myself enough, but I should. So I got a couple months ago, I got appointed by Governor Walz to the Minnesota Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy. That is the licensing board that oversees our license, right? I never in a million years thought I'd actually get appointed to that board. I mean, yeah, I applied because I thought it'd be cool, but I thought no way, because I don't work in treatment and I'm kind of a loud voice and anyways, I got appointed. And so my new role there is going to be, you know, board member, and I will help. I just did my onboarding a couple weeks ago and, you know, still going through. There's a lot of steps to become But here's what I hope to bring to the table. As a person that's worked in the field and now works outside of the field, and a person that does a lot of advocacy, and I wouldn't see myself as a traditional clinician, like I'm, you know, formerly incarcerated, you know, 18 years of recovery, tons of legislative and advocacy work. I hope to bring so I'm going to sit on one of the committees for reviewing people's infractions, right? When people get a complaint filed against them or have some, so I'm going to be on a review committee, but I hope to bring to that committee is a lens of a community person that like understands in restorative practices more than punitive practices. Like, right. And I hope one of the goals I have, and I know like some of our professionals in this field haven't agreed with this, but I want to see the associate's level degree as a standalone credential, that you could go get your 2-year degree, become an associate's level addiction counselor. And then we tried to introduce a bill like that back in 2018. We got shot down by the people that have very advanced degrees like masters and doctorates, because they said, we don't want less people with less education. We want people with more education. And I don't disagree. However, what I said to them at that time, I remember actually I said, if you can prove to me that because someone has a PhD, that the outcomes are better than because of my associate's degree, you'll win me over. There's no way to prove that outcome.
Well, they have the balls to do the research too.
Yeah. So we actually did a study and realized that if with the workforce shortages, we'd be better off to have a third credential, a lower, like that AS credential, because more people could then enter the field.
Yeah.
And so it helped alleviate some of the workforce shortages. So anyways, I'm hoping to revitalize that legislation. I'm sure I'll get pushback from a lot of people, and I don't really care, because what I saw when I was in school, when you got to that internship phase, like so many students dropped out or quit because like they just couldn't do it. Like it was too much of a burden to have a family, pay your bills, and then do this huge internship. And then after that, you got to go on still and get two more years of college. Like that's just not feasible financially for some people and for their life. Like in our field, the average age back when I was doing it was a person would enter this field at about 30, a little over 30 years old. So think about that. An adult person coming back into an educational setting, maybe with some or no college experience, and now you want them to put their life completely on hold for 4 or 5 years to complete this education. I mean, it's just not feasible. And then more student debt and all that stuff. So anyways, I would love to revisit that and see if we could bring that legislation back to life. And the only stipulation was they could have their ADCT, or we'd call it an ADC, but they would have to always be supervised. They would no longer, unlike LADC, I don't need supervision. If you want to be an associate's level, you would need to be supervised all the time. That was really the main difference. So anyways, that's what I hope to bring to the board is a little louder voice, honestly, a little bit more advocacy, and a little bit more of a community lens versus the clinical lens. That's what I'm hoping for. So
that's exactly like what I'm going through right now. So, it was a blessing that I had the ability to have a paid internship.
Yeah.
When I did my internship, which is cool. That's something I would like to push for also. For treatment centers to like pay their interns, because if I didn't have a paid internship, I didn't have any other income. Right. You know, I run an RCO, but I think it's safe to say I put more of my money in than I actually get out. You know what right. I mean? Just for the sake of the recovery community. But that's pretty much like what I'm going through now. Like I'm going for my bachelor's degree at Metro State part time, and I'm working full time.
Right.
You know, just to sustain, you know, sustain my life. Like, and on top of that, run a recovery community organization. So it's like, you know, it is kind of stressful. It's taxing. A lot of people don't see it, but it is, as far as like keeping everything balanced financially. Like I haven't got any grants and stuff like that yet. So yeah. I want to talk to you about that, Randy. But you know, if that was like to happen, you know, to have some type of funding for like my organization, that would take a lot of pressure, you know, off me personally, as far as like, you know, what I'm trying to do. But it, you know, it's, if I didn't have like a full time job, it's just doing, because I'm doing an internship now, my first junior internship. I'm in school for social work, so I'm doing my internship now in the summer. Then we have another one, I think, in the fall. Yeah. But you know, it's like it's exactly what I'm going through. Like if it was a two year thing versus a 4 year thing, which I do want to get my bachelor's degree, of course. But right. You know, I know a lot of people, it's been taxing for them that they even had to quit their jobs, like to complete school, and you know, or vice versa, had to quit school to complete their jobs. I haven't been in school in like 30 years. Not only have I been in school for 30 years, but I was homeless 5 years ago. So, you know what I mean? I have a lot of catching up to stuff that I'm trying to do as far as like within my life. Like that would be something that I would help push to Randy once I get to that, you know, to that level or whatever, you know, that's exactly what I'm going through like right now. But just to say that.
And there's some, I mean, not again, this is a great, this is one of my topics again with the Board of Behavioral Therapy that I hope to bring, but so I had a friend that went to school with me. His name was Ted Drago. Maybe you guys knew or didn't know him. Anyways, he became an LADC. He was an older guy in his 60s, retired from construction. But he had a bachelor's degree in, I don't remember the degree, in engineering or something from 1965, Hamline University, right? And that qualified him enough to go just get the 7 core classes and do an internship and then become an LADC. So explain... Someone needs to explain to me how that makes any sense. Yeah. Like, right? I mean, so that's some of the arguments I have is if you already have a bachelor's and it can be 20 years old, like that qualifies you. I'm like, what? That doesn't make any sense to me. Like, anyways, when I think of the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy, I just hope to bring a little different flavor to that board. I hope I don't piss too many people off in the process. I do keep in mind that this is Governor Walz is appointing me and like, it's a big deal. Right. I want to do that. I think I can do all of that in a very respectful way. I can do advocacy and help change some of that system and still be in a respectful community lens way. So, yeah.
Amen. Wow. Well, again, I had an absolute blast with you gentlemen. I had so much fun. I know the audience had a lot of fun. They were engaging. And it was a great pleasure.
Yeah, I love it.
But before we head out, do you want to just explain how I can get a hold of each one of you? I don't know if there's like an email or website you want to shout out so again they can send you a message.
Yeah, you can Minnesota Hope Dealers, Minnesota Hope Dealers with the Z.org, or the Facebook page. I also have a Facebook group. Or you can email me at jp@minnesotahopedealers.org.
Yeah, and mine, you can Google Bold North Recovery, pretty easy to find. I think I've done a great job with my SEO, which I learned all about. I am all self-taught. But anyways, you can go, I have a website, boldnorthrecoveryconsulting.com, or on Facebook, Bold North Recovery, easy to find. My email is pretty simple, info@boldnorthrecovery.com. So yeah, I send out a newsletter every couple weeks, you know, depending on how busy it is, sometimes every week, but I try to put a bunch of community stuff in there going on in our communities and some national stuff. So I try to keep people up to date on what's happening. But yeah, check us out. Someday I do have a dormant 501c3 that I hope to someday bring to life and maybe have my own RCO as well. I just have so much on my plate right now. I'm going to still thinking about it. So yeah, anyways, a lot of stuff going on, but
absolutely. Well, again, I had so much fun with you gentlemen and have a great day.
Thanks guys. See you, JP. See you, Jake.
Thanks for having me. See you later. Randy. Thanks, Jake.
I again want to thank Randy and JP for being awesome and amazing special guests on my show. I had a blast with them on. I just want to thank all of my listeners for your support. And just to inform everyone that the information expressed in this episode was not meant to be taken as therapeutic advice. If you do find yourself struggling with any type of mental health or addiction issues, please seek the care of a medical doctor or a licensed mental health therapist. And if anyone has any further questions for me, you can reach me at my email address, behavioralhealthintegration121@gmail.com. You can also find me on LinkedIn at Jacob Minig, where you will find more educational posts on psychotherapy, trauma, and addiction. And finally, you can follow me on my website, which is behavioralhealthintegration.org. I also want to inform everyone that there is a great new device out there called Comigo. It's a breathing device meant to control and manage your breathing rates and the depth of your breathing as you inhale and exhale to, again, help relieve any type of anxiety and stress-like symptoms. And if you do put the BHI podcast into the promo code, you get $30 off this amazing device. It is a once-in-a-lifetime deal, and you will not be disappointed. All right, everyone, until next time, have a good day. Bye.